Chapter 22. Ray left his car on double yellow lines and jogged into Chinatown. Ray was a big fan of Chinese food and over the years had visited most of the restaurants in the area. Den had done business there too, and it was through one of the business deals that Ray had met Jimmy Chen. Jimmy was British-born, but his parents had flown him back to Hong Kong during his school holidays to stay with his grandparents to make sure he remained fluent in Cantonese and Mandarin. What they didn't expect was for Jimmy Chen to fall in with the 14K Tai Huan Chai triad when he was in his early teens, and by the time he graduated from South Bank University with a degree in economics, he was a fully-fledged white paper fan, a triad administrator. During the week, Jimmy worked for a bank in the city from where he laundered much of the triad's London profits, but at the weekends, he still helped out at his parents' Chinese supermarket. Den used 14K's connections to ship cannabis from Thailand to the UK, and much of the money he had paid had gone through Jimmy. Money was taken in cash to the supermarket, and Jimmy always insisted on giving them a receipt in Chinese, saying that his bosses at 14K insisted on it. Ray knew that Den wouldn't be happy about him calling on Jimmy unannounced, but Ray didn't see that he had any choice. The supermarket was busy, packed with Asians stocking up with the products they couldn't get at a regular British supermarket. Things like duck's feet and pig entrails and all sorts of exotic vegetables. Jimmy was sitting behind one of the cash registers, and his eyes widened in surprise when he saw Ray. "What's up?" he asked.
"I need a word in private," said Ray.
"I'm busy, mate. Up to my eyes." He gestured at the queue of Asian housewives lined up in front of him.
"It won't take long," said Ray.
"Mate, seriously, you'll have to come back." Ray opened his jacket just enough for Jimmy to see the butt of his gun.
"I could fire a shot into the ceiling and see what that does for trade," he said.
"What the fuck is wrong with you?" hissed Jimmy. One of the Chinese housewives barked at him in Cantonese, but he ignored her.
"Jimmy, back room, now, or I'll start making a fuss."
Jimmy cursed in Chinese, stood up and apologized to the customers. An elderly man sitting at the other cash register shouted over at Jimmy, and Jimmy waved his hands and shouted back. Jimmy pushed open the door that led to the storeroom, and Ray followed him inside. It was where Jimmy wrote out his receipts. There were shelves piled high with sacks of rice and cans of produce, with a small metal desk and chair in the far corner next to a metal filing cabinet.
"What the fuck is going on?"
asked Jimmy, trying to act aggressively, but failing miserably. He was a good 6 inches shorter than Ray, and probably half the muscle mass, and from the look of him, wasn't privy to any of the exotic Chinese martial arts. Ray back-heeled the door shut.
"I need your help, Jimmy," he said.
"What the fuck are you doing here, Ray?"
"If you'd shut the fuck up, I'll tell you."
Ray took out his phone.
"You shouldn't be here. This is my business. What if the cops are watching me? This isn't..."
Ray held up a hand to silence him.
"Chill, Jimmy."
"Chill? What the fuck do you mean, chill? You come in here, waving your gun around..."
Ray slapped him across the face, and Jimmy fell back.
"I did not wave my gun, Jimmy. Will you shut the fuck up and listen to me? I don't have much time."
Jimmy's lip had split, and blood trickled down his chin. Jimmy touched the blood and then stared at his fingertips.
"What the fuck, Ray?"
"Just fucking chill, Jimmy. Take deep breaths and calm the fuck down."
Ray held the phone in front of Jimmy's face.
"You ever seen a tattoo like this? Probably some Chinese enforcer. Triads, maybe."
Jimmy squinted his eyes. They were watering and he was having trouble focusing. Ray thrust the phone into his trembling hands.
"Zoom for yourself."
Jimmy fiddled with the phone, stared at the screen, then nodded.
"Yeah, that's Teddy Kang. What's he done?"
"You sure?"
Jimmy nodded.
"Yeah, I'd recognize that scorpion anywhere. And the Chinese character for the number 7. That's how many men he's supposed to have killed in China."
Ray took the phone back and put it in his pocket, ignoring the question.
"Who is he?"
"Enforcer for C.K. Lee. You heard of him?"
"No."
"Lee's a nasty piece of work, and Kang's his Red Pole."
"What the fuck's a Red Pole?"
"That's what the triads call their enforcers."
"This C.K. Lee is 14K.
Jimmy shook his head.
"Wop Hop Toe. His boss is a guy called Yung Jaw Lung. He's even nastier than Lee. Wop Hop Toe are mega in Hong Kong and San Francisco. Not so big here."
"Where can I find this Lee?"
Jimmy shrugged. Ray drew back his hand to slap Jimmy again, and Jimmy flinched.
"For fuck's sake, Ray, what's wrong with you? If I knew, I'd tell you. I know him, but I don't know where he lives."
"What about Kang?"
Jimmy wiped his bleeding chin again.
"Ray, mate, they don't hand out business cards. It's like, I don't know where you live, right? But I know you."
He dabbed his chin with his sleeve.
"I'm starting to wish I didn't."
"What do you know about Lee? What's his story?"
"Like I said, he's a nasty piece of work. Extortion, protection rackets, gambling."
"Drugs?"
"Not that I know of. Gambling is his big thing."
"Football?"
Jimmy nodded.
"Football, sure. Horses, too. And he runs illegal casinos. Chinese places. You wouldn't get a look in. What's your problem with him?"
"That's for me to know, Jimmy."
"No problem. But be careful. I heard that Lee just hacked the finger off a guy who owed him money. That's his thing. He charges interest in fingers."
"This guy who lost a finger. You know him?"
Jimmy nodded. "Sammy Wu. Been around forever."
"Got an address?"
"What do you think I am, the Yellow fucking Pages?"
He flinched as Ray drew back his hand.
"No, I don't have an address for him."
"Where does he hang out?"
"Well, if he fell foul of C.K. Lee, there's a good chance he'd have gone to his illegal gambling den above a restaurant in Lyle Street. The one with the ducks in the window, top floor."
"Like a casino?"
Some mahjong, but mainly sports betting. "You're wasting your time, though. There's no way they'll let a Guelo in."
"Guelo?"
"Foreigner."
"Fuck me, Jimmy. This is my country. I'm not a fucking foreigner."
"You are in Chinatown, and here you always will be."
He wiped his still bleeding mouth. "Are we done?"
"Yeah. Thanks."
Ray headed for the door.
"Why are you so fucking grouchy?"
asked Jimmy, dabbing at his chin again. Ray stopped and turned to look at him.
"My family's in trouble. This Lee's behind it, I think."
"Well, you should have said," muttered Jimmy. "Nothing matters more than family, I get that."
"I'm sorry."
"It's a bit late for sorry, Ray."
Ray hurried out, ignoring the accusatory stares of the Chinese housewives queuing at the tills. Chapter 23. Laura rolled over as she heard the door open. It was one of her captors, as always wearing a ski mask. She fixed him with her eyes and grunted through the duct tape that had been wound around her mouth after she'd made the FaceTime call to Gabe.
"No one can hear you," said the man.
He was dressed in black and had a brown leather shoulder holster on top of his pullover, in which nestled a grey gun. She increased the urgency of her grunts until eventually he walked over to the bed and looked down at her.
"I told you, shut up."
She shook her head, held his gaze, and grunted again. The man reached into his back pocket and pulled out a flick knife. He pressed a chrome button on the side, and the blade flicked out. It was at least 6 inches long, and it glinted as he waved it back and forth over her face. Laura kept trying to talk. She doubted that he would kill her, at least not while they needed Gabe to carry out their orders. And if he was going to hurt her, a slap would be more effective. The knife was to intimidate, that was all.
"Shut up," said the man.
She could see two tattoos on his right hand, a scorpion and a Chinese character. He was Chinese, she realized. She hadn't noticed the eyes before, but he was definitely Chinese. She began breathing hard and fast, the duct tape pulsing in and out. The man snarled at her, stuck the blade between her flesh and the tape, and cut off the gag.
"Just let me talk, just for a minute," she gasped.
"If you don't shut up, I'll put the bag back over your head," said the man.
"Listen to me, please. There's no need to gag us."
"You don't tell me what to do," said the man.
"My son can't breathe."
"He's okay."
"He's not okay. I'm a doctor, and I can tell you he's not okay. If you gag a child like that and he throws up, he can choke on his own vomit."
"He won't throw up."
"And he's asthmatic. He has breathing problems."
That was a lie, but she would say anything to get them to take the gag off Ollie.
"Asthmatic?
He has trouble breathing. If he gets upset, and what you're doing is upsetting him."
The man turned to look at Ollie, and he shrugged.
"He looks okay."
"Are you a father?"
"Why do you ask that?"
"Because if you were and something like this happened to your child, you'd want them to be as comfortable as possible. You wouldn't want him to be tied up like an animal, would you?" The man looked at Ollie, then back at her.
Look, we won't shout or scream, and even if we did, I don't think anyone would hear us, would they? We're tied up, so we can't run away. Can't you just take off our gags? At least then, if he's scared, I can reassure him.
She forced a smile.
Please, can you do that?
The man held her gaze for several seconds, then he nodded slowly.
Okay, he said. But if either of you make a sound, I'll have to put the tape back on.
Sure, said Laura. We'll be quiet.
The man went over to the sofa. Ollie looked up at him, his eyes wide with fear.
It's okay, Ollie, don't worry, Laura called over to him. He's going to take the gag off your mouth. Just take deep breaths and relax. Everything is going to be fine.
The man used the knife to carefully cut the duct tape away from Ollie's mouth.
Mum, he said. Mum, what's happening?
Shh, Ollie, said Laura. We have to be quiet.
But what's happening?
Ollie, listen to me. Everything is going to be all right, but we have to be quiet. Can you do that for me? Just for a while.
Okay, Mum, said Ollie,
but she could hear the uncertainty in his voice.
Just pretend it's a game, said Laura.
The man straightened up, still holding the knife. He tossed the pieces of duct tape onto the floor.
Thank you, said Laura. You're a good man. Just keep quiet, said the man.
She tried to smile as brightly as possible.
Can I bother you for something else?
His look hardened.
What?
Just water, she said. I'm really, really thirsty, and I'm sure my son is too. If you could get us some water, that would be wonderful.
The man waved the knife at her and then nodded.
Okay, he said. I will get you water.
Her smile widened.
That's so nice of you. Thank you.
The man grunted and left the room. Laura listened intently and heard the man head downstairs.
Ollie, can you hear me? She whispered. Yes, Mum.
It's going to be all right, she said. I promise.
Who are they, Mum?
They're just bad men, but they won't hurt us.
They want Daddy to lose the game, right?
That's right.
Will he do that?
He'll do whatever he has to so that we get home safely, she said. Just trust in him, and trust in me. Everything is going to be okay. I know this is a bit scary, but think of it like a movie. It'll be all right by the end.
Okay, Mum.
Laura bit down on her lip as she heard the uncertainty in her son's voice. Was it going to be all right? Life wasn't like a movie. Everything wasn't always all right by the time the credits rolled. Bad things often happened to good people, especially when the bad people were wearing ski masks. But the ski masks were a good sign, Laura realized. If they didn't want them to see their faces, that meant there was a good chance they would be released when it was all over. That was the hope she clung to as she lay on her side and stared at the wall. Chapter 24
Earth to Gabe!
Shouted McNamara. The coach was standing some 10 feet away from Gabe, but the footballer didn't react.
Gabe!
Shouted McNamara. Gabe shook his head. Sorry, what? McNamara jogged over.
Are you okay?
Asked the coach. It's like you're a million miles away.
Sorry, Joe, I didn't sleep well last night.
Gabe couldn't think of a better lie.
I need you on top form for this game, Gabe, said McNamara. You're the captain, and you need to be leading from the front.
Gabe nodded enthusiastically.
I'm fine, he said.
He jumped up and down on the spot, raring to go. McNamara patted him on the back.
I'm depending on you, Gabe.
He put his whistle between his lips and blew hard.
Right, guys, pair up, and let's do some stretching.
Gabe paired off with Michael Devereux. Following McNamara's instructions, they stood back-to-back and linked arms, taking it in turns to bend forward and take the other man's weight. Gabe did the moves on autopilot. All he could think about was Laura and Ollie and the danger they were in. Chapter 25 Ray hurried down Lyle Street. Chinatown was busy and there were people waiting outside most of the restaurants.
He found the one with a line of roast ducks hanging from a stainless steel bar in the window. To the left of the entrance was a red door. There was an intercom next to it with a single button. He stabbed at it with his finger, and after a few seconds someone spoke in guttural Chinese.
"Yeah, it's me," he said.
There was no response. He stabbed at the button again, but there was only silence. He looked up and saw a CCTV camera pointing down at him. He grinned and flashed the camera a thumbs up, but nothing happened.
"Bastards," he muttered,
and walked across the road to stand in front of a dim sum restaurant. He looked up at the top floor of the building opposite. The windows had been covered with what looked like aluminium foil. The roof seemed to be flat, and he could see the rims of two large satellite dishes. He paced up and down as he considered his options, which basically came down to abseiling down from the roof or finding someone to let him in. He looked at his watch and cursed. It would soon be midday, just 3 hours from kickoff. As the minutes ticked by, he considered going back to see Jimmy Chen and press him for more information, though he guessed that would be flogging a dead horse. Two middle-aged Chinese women in long wool coats and with almost matching floppy hats walked by the duck restaurant, deep in conversation. But when they reached the red door, they stopped talking, and the shorter of the two reached up and pressed the button. Ray put his phone to his ear and faked a call as he jogged across the road. The women were just disappearing into the hallway when Ray reached the door, and he caught it just before it closed. He eased it open and slipped inside. The women were chatting away again and hadn't noticed him. He let them go up the stairs and around the corner before he headed up after them. There was a door on the first floor, but the two women kept on going. Ray followed, treading softly so as to make no sound. There was another door on the second floor. Ray heard them knock, and he hurried up so that he arrived just as the women were going inside. Ray heard loud clicking noises and the occasional dull thud. He followed them, keeping his face away from whoever had opened the door. There was one long room with a bar to the left and a dozen small tables where mahjong was being played, mainly by elderly Chinese women. They were banging their tiles on the table with every move, and no one seemed to care about the near deafening noise. At the far end of the room were four large screen televisions, all showing sport. One was tuned to horse racing, and three were showing football programs, including Sky TV. Ray looked over at the screen and realized the view was the pitch where Gabe would be playing. More than a dozen Chinese men were standing around watching the screens. Moving among them were two Chinese teenagers in grey suits who were constantly tapping on iPads, presumably collecting bets. There was a gents' toilet and a ladies' at the end of the bar. Off to the right was a roulette table with more than a dozen Chinese crowded around it, and there were two fully occupied blackjack tables beyond it. The men were busy watching the screens, and the women were caught up in their mahjong games, so Ray got halfway along the bar before anyone realized there was a non-Chinese in the room. One of the barmen shouted at a heavy in a black suit who was standing by the roulette table croupier. The heavy came over. He was a few inches shorter than Ray, but looked like he could handle himself.
"This is for members only," grunted the heavy.
Ray smiled easily.
"I'm only passing through," he said. "I'm looking for Teddy Kang."
The man frowned.
"You know Teddy?"
"Yeah, I know Teddy."
The man scowled. "I don't think so.
Don't fuck me around. Where is he?"
The man grabbed Ray's arm and tried to pull him towards the door, but Ray stood rooted to the spot. The man tried harder, but Ray was a good deal heavier and stronger, and he didn't budge. Ray grinned, then he moved, so quickly that before the man had any idea what had happened, his right arm was wedged up behind his back, and he was being frog-marched to the toilet. Ray kept the hold on with his right hand and opened the toilet door with his left. He pushed the man inside and bolted the door. There was a line of urinals, a small sink with a paper towel dispenser above it, and one foul-smelling, unoccupied stall. The man struggled, but Ray yanked his arm up higher until he went still. Then he put his foot behind the man's right knee and pushed him down to the floor. The man yelped in pain, but his cries were silenced when Ray pushed his head into the toilet and pressed the flush button. Water gushed round the man's head, and he struggled frantically, but Ray's grip was too strong.
"Where's Teddy Kang?" shouted Ray.
He pulled the man's head up.
"Where the fuck is Teddy Kang?"
The man gasped for breath, and Ray pushed his head down into the water again and held him there for 20 seconds or so, ignoring the banging on the door. Ray pulled the man's head out of the toilet bowl again. The toilet had stopped flushing, and the system was refilling.
"I can do this all fucking day," said Ray. "Now where is Teddy Kang?"
"I don't know," sputtered the man. "Not seen him all day."
"Is he with C.K. Lee?"
"Probably."
"What about Sammy Wu? Where does Sammy Wu live?"
The man hesitated, and Ray shoved his head back into the toilet and hit the flush button. The man struggled, but Ray kept his face pressed into the water for a full 30 seconds before pulling him out. The man coughed and spluttered, and then gasped for breath.
"Where's Sammy Wu?"
"At home. Teddy worked him over pretty bad."
"Where's home?"
"Camden."
"Where in Camden?"
"I don't know," said the man.
Ray started to push his head back into the toilet, but the man struggled.
"Okay, okay," he said,
and gave Ray the address. Ray grabbed the man by his collar and yanked him to his feet.
"Thanks for your help," said Ray,
then slammed the man's dripping wet head against the tiled wall and let him slump to the floor. He unlocked the door and pulled it open, then cursed when he saw the four Chinese heavies waiting for him. They were all wearing ill-fitting suits and cheap shoes, but unlike Jimmy Chen, their stances suggested they could handle themselves.
"I'm done here," said Ray. "Just let me on my way."
The four heavies didn't move. From the look of the way they were standing, three were right-handed and one was a lefty. The lefty looked as if he favoured kicking to punching, and the man closest to him had his forward hand open, telegraphing his intention to grab. The customers who weren't sitting at the tables had moved to the far end of the room, like sheep huddling away from dogs. Ray reached into his jacket and pulled out his Glock.
"I'm going," he said. "I've got things to do."
He stepped to the side, moving towards the exit. The four heavies moved with him, their eyes watchful.
"Easy does it," said Ray.
The lefty started bobbing from side to side as if he was about to attack, so Ray pointed the gun at his chest.
"Take it easy, mate," said Ray. "I've never seen a kung fu move yet could block a bullet."
The heavy had taken the opportunity to move closer, and he warned him off with his gun.
"I'm going," he said. "No harm done."
One of the heavies said something in Chinese and spat on the floor.
I know, said Ray, but I'm the one with the gun, so you're just going to have to get over it.
The heavy to his left also said something, and they all started to move towards him. Ray moved his gun from side to side, trying to cover them all.
Come on in, he said. Which one of you wants a bullet in the balls? He said,
still moving towards the door. He had his game face on, but it was clear that they weren't buying it, and he knew why. If he did pull the trigger, then the shots would be heard outside in the street, and if he was the intruder, he was the one with a weapon. If the cops arrived, he'd be the one hauled off to jail, but even before the cops could get there, the ones that he hadn't managed to shoot would beat him to a pulp. He continued to back towards the door, his finger on the trigger.
Let's just call this a day, shall we? No hard feelings. Live and let live.
Another heavy had appeared from a side room. He was big, his shoulders straining the material of his cheap black suit. He had a black metal tube in his right hand, and he flicked it out and it extended to 2 feet of metal. He walked confidently towards Ray, swinging the baton back and forth. Ray pointed the Glock at the man's chest, but that didn't seem to faze him in the least. He barked something in Chinese, and the lefty answered, then grinned savagely. Ray's mind raced, while his face stayed a blank mask. There were 15 rounds in the clip, enough to put 3 bullets in each of the heavies, but being responsible for a massacre in a Chinese gambling den meant his future would be bleak, to say the least. He kept the gun moving from side to side, figuring that none of them would want to be the first to take a bullet. But once he pulled the trigger, it would all move into overdrive, he was sure of that. He couldn't risk a look over his shoulder, but he knew that he had about 10 feet to go before he reached the door. At least in the hallway outside, he'd have more of a chance of fighting them off, because they'd have to come at him in single file. The big guy was holding the baton above his head, and Ray was considering the merits of firing a warning shot when a bottle of Tsingtao beer arced through the air and slammed into his shoulder. Froth sprayed across his face, temporarily blinding him, and when his eyes cleared, The guy with the baton was lashing out. Ray jumped back, but the baton caught the barrel of the Glock and sent it clattering to the floor. The heavy, to Ray's right, kicked at his groin, but Ray grabbed his ankle with his left hand and smacked him in the mouth with his right fist, sending him crashing into the wall. A second heavy threw a punch at Ray's face, but it was slow, and Ray had all the time in the world to pivot on his back leg, grab the wrist, and then twist it up and around so that the man had no choice but to go with it. That left him with his face looking down and his right arm up in the air. Ray brought his knee up and felt the man's nose crack and splinter. He let go of the arm and jumped back, hands close to his head. The big heavy with the baton swung it around, and despite his bulk, he was fast, so all Ray could do was use his hands to block the arm. The blow knocked him back, but as he moved, he managed to backfist the man in the face, smashing his nose. Blood spurted down his chin, but other than that, the blow didn't seem to affect him. He raised his baton again, and Ray dropped and punched him several times in the solar plexus, putting all his weight behind the punches. The man grunted, but stood his ground. Ray threw a final punch, this time at the man's groin, and finally he had the satisfaction of hearing the man scream in pain. Ray straightened up, but as he did, a foot caught him in the small of the back, and he fell against the big man. The big man grabbed him in a bear hug and began to squeeze. The man snarled in Ray's face, and Ray smelled stale garlic and onions. Ray drew back his head, then smashed his forehead down on the man's already broken nose. The man released his grip on Ray, and Ray chopped him hard across the throat before turning around just in time to catch the lefty midway through a vicious kick that would have felled him if it had landed. Ray had just enough time to twist away from the kick, then he swept the other man's leg away from him. The man seemed to freeze for a second, parallel to the floor, then gravity kicked in, and he hit the ground hard. Ray kicked him in the side, then headed for the door. As he grabbed for the door handle, he remembered the Glock, but he took a quick look over his shoulder and realized there was no way he could get to it. He pulled open the door and ran into the hallway and down the stairs. He heard the thud of feet behind him, so he stopped, turned, and punched his pursuer twice in the stomach. The man's breath exploded from his lungs, and Ray pushed him back. As the man hit the stairs, Ray turned and continued to run down, taking the stairs two at a time. He threw open the door to the street and almost fell onto the pavement. Shoppers turned to look at him, and he straightened up and forced a smile. There were more footsteps behind him. Ray turned again just in time to confront the last of the heavies, who'd produced a knife and was charging towards him, his face contorted with rage. Ray waited until the last second, then pulled the door hard, smashing it into the man's shoulder and sending him crashing against the wall. Ray pushed the door open, then kicked the man between the legs with so much force that the man flew through the air and crashed into the stairs. Ray pulled the door closed and walked away, breathing slowly and evenly. A West Indian parking warden was standing by the BMW, tapping on his handheld terminal.
"You can't park here," said the warden.
"Yeah, but I did, didn't I?" said Ray.
He had scraped the knuckles of his right hand, and he licked them as the warden printed out a ticket and held it out.
"You know where you can shove that," said Ray,
pulling open the door and climbing in. The warden pulled up a windscreen wiper and shoved the ticket under it.
"Doesn't matter whether you take it or not. You have to pay," said the traffic warden.
Ray scowled at him and drove off. The parking ticket wasn't a problem. He never paid them, or speeding tickets. The car wasn't registered in his name. It was taxed and insured through a shell company. He never held onto a car for more than 3 months, and he bought and sold them for cash through a dealer he knew in Battersea. This one he'd be dumping by the end of the day, no matter how things played out.
Chapter 26. At 12 noon on the dot, McNamara brought the practice to an end with a long blow on his whistle.
"Hit the showers, guys," he shouted. "We're leaving at 12:30 sharp."
Gabe ran to the changing rooms and pulled open his locker door. He grabbed at his phone. One missed call from Ray. He stabbed at the screen and listened to the brief message that Ray had left, then called him back. McNamara came into the changing rooms as the phone was ringing out, and he pointed an accusatory finger at him.
"That's 500 quid, Gabe. You know the rules."
"Cho, this is important."
"Doesn't matter,"
said the coach.
No phones in the changing rooms. Manager's rules.
It's a stupid rule, said Gabe.
Take it up with the boss, said McNamara. Me? I think he's right. Now's the time to be focused on the game.
Gabe put his phone back in the locker.
Fine.
Are you okay?
Gabe opened his mouth and was about to give McNamara a piece of his mind. Then he got a grip on himself and forced a smile. There was no point in antagonising the coach, and he was right. They were the manager's rules.
Just feeling the pressure, Joe. I've never been captain before.
He took off his boots and put them in his kit bag, then sat down and ran his hands through his hair.
You'll be fine, said McNamara. The guys look up to you. The role could have been yours, irrespective of Eric going walkabout.
Gabe nodded.
Thanks. I mean it, Gabe. You've always been an asset to this team, not just as a bloody good player, but as a calming influence for the younger lads as well. They listen to you. They respect you.
Gabe looked up and smiled, and this time he meant it.
Thanks, Joe.
McNamara patted him on the shoulder.
I'm not blowing smoke up your arse, Gabe. I mean it.
He jerked a thumb at the showers.
Now, get showered, and we'll be on our way.
McNamara went over to talk to second assistant coach Martin Jessop, a grey-haired former England winger who was the longest-serving member of the coaching staff. The two men stood by the door, and there was no way that Gabe could take out his phone without them seeing him. So he stripped off his kit, grabbed a towel, and headed to the showers.
Chapter 27. Teddy Kang and Billy Huang were sitting on a low grey leather sofa, their feet up on a marble coffee table as they watched the large screen TV mounted above an ornate fireplace. They had helped themselves to a bottle of brandy and two balloon glasses, taking care to choose a bottle from inside the drinks cabinet rather than one of the expensive brands on display. They weren't expecting CK Lee to return any time soon, and they figured they'd earned a drink. On the screen, two former footballers were discussing the upcoming Chelsea match against the backdrop of the stadium. Huang waved his glass at the screen.
Did you put a bet on?
Kang grinned.
Be stupid not to. You?
I wasn't sure.
You weren't sure? How could you not be sure? You know he's going to win.
He shrugged.
Up to you.
There was a bowl of shelled peanuts on the table, and Kang leaned over and grabbed a handful.
What happens afterwards? Asked Huang.
Kang frowned.
What do you mean?
Huang gestured up at the ceiling.
When the game's over, what happens to them?
I don't know. It's up to CK.
Do you think he'll want us to kill them?
Maybe, maybe not.
I think he'll want us to kill them.
It's possible, said Kang.
He looked across at Huang.
Is that a problem?
I've never killed a woman or a kid.
Kang looked at the television and sipped his brandy.
It's no different to killing a man. Killing's killing. Same as eating. Do you care how old the cow was when you eat a steak? Meat's meat.
They sat in silence for more than a minute, watching the television and sipping their brandy before Huang spoke again.
Have you?
Kang kept his eyes on the screen.
Have I what?
Killed a woman or a kid? Kang held his hand out, showing Huang the two tattoos.
The seven I killed in China. One was a woman. One was a boy.
He shrugged and took back his hand.
It was no big thing.
What happened?
Kang sighed.
Why do you want to know?
Because I want to know what it's like.
Kang sipped his brandy again. He kept his eyes on the screen as he spoke.
It was about a year before I left Shenzhen. Someone had stolen money from Yong Jialong, a couple of million Hong Kong dollars. He knew it was one of three men who worked for him, but he didn't know which one it was. So we worked them over for days. No one talked. The one who'd done it knew that if he confessed, he was dead. So no one confessed. No matter what we did to them. And we did a lot.
He took another drink before continuing in a low, dull monotone.
So Yong Jialong tells us to get their wives and children. They're one each. One child policy. Two had sons, one had a daughter. We lined the wives up, and Yong Jialong tells the men that if one of them doesn't confess, all three of the women will die. But if the culprit confessed, all three women would be spared.
he shrugged.
No one confessed.
So you killed them?
I killed one of them. There were three Redpoles. I was the youngest, still making a name for myself.
And how did you kill her? Kang made a throat-cutting gesture with his hand.
And the kids? Asked Wang,
fiddling with his jade ring. Kang recognized it as a sign of nervousness. Wang always played with the ring when he had something on his mind.
Kang shrugged. Yung Jolung had us line the kids up in front of the men. He told them the same thing. If the culprit confessed, the kids would live. If he didn't, he shrugged.
And what happened?
No confessions. So the kids died.
You used the knife again? Kang nodded.
One clean cut.
And that didn't worry you? Kang shrugged, his eyes still on the screen.
Meat's meat.
The two men drank in silence for a while, but Huang had more questions.
So, who stole the money? We never found out, said Kang. They all died?
We killed the wives, we killed the kids, then we killed the men.
Why would the man do that? Why would he stay silent while you killed them all?
Kang sighed, bored with the conversation.
He probably thought that he was dead anyway, which is true. If he had confessed, he would have had to give the money back to Yung Jolung. Then he would have been killed, and his family too. You know what Yung Jolung is like. At least this way, someone in his family would still have the money. He shrugged. As to the other families, he wouldn't care. Why would he? Does anyone really give a fuck about anyone else?
They both sipped their brandy. There is another possibility, said Huang eventually.
What's that?
Maybe none of them stole the money. Maybe it was someone else. Maybe all those people died for nothing. Kang turned to look up at him, his eyes cold.
Why don't you shut the fuck up? Said Kang. And that's not a rhetorical question.
Chapter 28. The squad filed out of the main building at 12:30 on the dot. The team bus was waiting for them, engine running. Mancini, Armati and Moretti were the first on, as usual, so that they could grab the three seats at the back. All the players were dressed in suits and ties at the insistence of the manager. They were all dark-haired, but other than that had little in common physically. Mancini was dark-skinned and sported designer stubble. He was heavy-set and well-muscled. Armati was taller and had his hair gelled into place and cultivated a perfectly trimmed goatee, and Moretti was balding with a large cleft in his chin and a nose that had been broken several times. The three Italians competed to buy the most stylish suit, and it looked as if Armati was winning, no doubt helped by his Hugo Boss connection. The manager's insistence on suits and ties was one of his more esoteric rules, because the players stayed on the coach until they arrived at the stadium, and there were no photograph opportunities as they got off the coach. But Gattuso insisted, claiming that it was necessary to build team spirit. Not wearing a suit incurred a fine of £1,000, and missing a tie was another £250. Gabe hung back, looking for an opportunity to use his phone. He saw Tommy Brett looking at him, and Gabe faked a grimace and rubbed his stomach.
"Tommy, I need to use the toilet."
"Use the one on the bus," said Brett.
"I'll stink the place out," said Gabe. "I had vegetarian last night. You wouldn't want to put the guys through it."
"More information than I needed," laughed Brett. He gestured at the building. "Get a move on." Gabe waved his thanks and jogged back to the main door. Tim Mapplethorpe was the last to leave, knotting his tie. He was tall and wide-shouldered, and his suits always seemed to be a size too small for him.
"Where are you going?"
"Toilet," said Gabe, hurrying inside. Mapplethorpe grinned.
"Nerves, eh?"
Gabe let the door slam behind him before pulling out his phone and calling Ray's number. Ray answered on the third ring.
"Ray, what's happening?" asked Gabe, his voice trembling.
"I'm on my way to see a guy called Sammy Wu. I'm hoping he knows where C.K. Lee is."
Gabe frowned. "Who the fuck is C.K. Lee?" he asked.
"One of the guys in the pictures you sent me is a triad enforcer who works for a Chinese gangster called C.K. Lee. Lee is big-time into gambling, so he could well be trying to rig this match."
"You think this Lee has my family?"
"I think he's behind it, yeah."
"So let's call in the cops. Get them looking for Laura and Ollie."
"Look where, Gabe? All I have is the name.
I don't know where he lives, and if he finds out the cops are involved, he might just have them killed. I'm on my way to see a gambler that Lee has gotten heavy with. His name's Sammy Wu. I'm hoping this Wu will tell me where I can find Lee. Ray, kickoff is in 2.5 hours.
I know, so we've got time.
And what if the match starts? What am I supposed to do?
That's your call, Gabe. But I won't let you down.
Where are you? Training ground. We'll be on the coach at 1:30 and at the stadium about 1.
I'll call you when I have something, said Ray.
I might not be able to answer. They have a thing about us using phones.
I'll text you, said Ray.
Don't worry, I'll keep you in the loop. Gabe ran a hand through his hair. Thanks for this, Ray.
Fuck that, said Ray. You're my little brother, and no one fucks with my little brother.
Chapter 29. Ray ended the call and concentrated on the road. Then his phone rang again. Ray picked it up and looked at the screen. It was Donovan. Ray cursed and took the call.
What the fuck's going on, Ray? Snapped Donovan.
What do you mean?
You know what I fucking mean. You want to tell me why you're charging around Chinatown, waving your gun around?
That's not what happened.
Then explain to me why you beat the fuck out of Jimmy Chen.
You don't want to piss off the 14K, Ray. They take no fucking prisoners.
I didn't beat him up.
You slapped him around, that's what I heard.
Look, I'll send him flowers, okay? I just didn't have time for please and thank you, and he was playing silly buggers.
Which brings me back to my first question. What the fuck is going on?
Ray took a deep breath. He and Donovan went back a long way, but at the end of the day, Ray was the hired hand, and Donovan was the boss.
Then, I can't tell you.
You see how that doesn't cut any ice with me, don't you? The 14K do a lot for me, and if I lose their trust, it will cost me an arm and a leg, and I mean that figuratively, and probably fucking literally as well.
This isn't about the 14K.
Then tell that to Jimmy Chen.
He had some information I needed, and I didn't have time to fuck around. I didn't hurt him then, not as much as I could have.
What's going on, Ray? It's not like you to go, Maverick.
Ray took another deep breath.
It's Gabe. He's in trouble.
With a 14K?
No, but maybe another triad.
How the fuck does a professional footballer get mixed up with triads?
I don't know.
Don't fucking lie to me, Ray. I deserve better than to have you bullshitting me.
Telling you won't help, said Ray.
No, but it might stop me having you put down like a mad dog.
Are you threatening me, Den?
You're the one who's threatening me, mate. Threatening my business. Threatening relationships I've spent years building up.
This is personal. It's nothing to do with your business.
Where are you, eh?
I'm in North London.
I need you back here.
No can do, Den. Sorry.
Don't fucking sorry me, Ray. You're my attack dog, and I need you to come to heel now.
Ray opened his mouth to reply, but then realised there was nothing he could say to placate Donovan.
I'll call you back, he said, and switched off the phone.
Donovan rang back a few seconds later. Ray let the call go through to voicemail. He reached Camden. He put the address the triad heavy had given him into the BMW sat-nav, but from the look of the map on the screen, it was planning to take him the long way around. He swore. He didn't know the area well enough to try a rat run, and the sat-nav was telling him he was 9 minutes away. He saw a car park to his left and he drove in. He took a ticket from an automatic dispenser and drummed his fingers on the steering wheel while he waited for the barrier to rise. He found a space and took a last look at the sat-nav before locking up the BMW and starting to jog through the crowded streets.
Chapter 30.
Sammy Wu was lying on his sofa, a bottle of Johnny Walker Red Label whiskey and a carton of day-old fried rice on the coffee table next to him. He was watching Sky Sports. The Walford United-Chelsea teams were on the screen and being discussed by two pundits who appeared to love the sound of their own voices. Wu had £5,000 wagered on the game, not with C.K. Lee, obviously, because C.K. Lee had stopped taking his bets. Wu had found a Vietnamese guy who would let him bet on credit, but only on condition that Wu used his car as security, along with two Rolex watches that Wu had owned for years. The Vietnamese had taken the watches and made Wu sign over his car before giving him a £5,000 line of credit. The man was cheating him because the watches alone were worth twice that, but Wu knew that beggars couldn't be choosers, especially beggars who'd already lost one finger for late payment. The bookies all rated United as surefire winners, but Wu had been able to get half-decent odds on goal difference. He was sure he'd double his money at the very least. His door intercom rang, and he ignored it. He wasn't expecting anyone. He sipped his whiskey. The doorbell rang again, more insistent this time. He put down his glass and reached for his walking stick. The bell continued to ring as he pushed himself up off the sofa and hobbled over to the door. His left hand was still too painful to use, so he tucked the stick under his arm and picked up the phone with his right. "Who is it?" he asked in Cantonese.
"Sammy Wu."
It was Aguelo.
"Yeah?" "I need to talk to you."
"I'm busy, and I don't know you."
"Sammy, stop fucking about. If you don't buzz me in right now, I'll kick the fucking door down, and then do the same to you."
Wu shook his head contemptuously and hung up the intercom. He was just settling back on the sofa when he heard rapid footsteps on the stairs outside. He frowned, then flinched as someone banged on the door.
"Open up, Sammy, or I swear I will blow your fucking ass down."
Wu struggled to his feet and limped over to the small kitchen at the back of the flat. He pulled open a drawer and took out a carving knife, just as the front door slammed open with a splintering sound. The man who had kicked it open stepped into the room. He was tall, well over 6 feet, broad-shouldered and with murder in his eyes. Wu held the knife out.
"I've got a knife," he stuttered.
"Yeah, I can see that," said the man.
He slammed the door shut behind him, and it banged against the splintered jamb.
"Look, my name's Ray Savage. I'm a friend of Jimmy Chen's. I just want to talk to you."
"About what?"
"C.K. Lee."
Wu shook his head. "Never heard of him."
"See, now, Sammy, we both know that's a lie. Now, stop being a dickhead and put down that knife."
"Get the fuck out of my flat,"
shouted Sammy. He limped towards Ray, slashing with the knife. Ray waited until the blade had swung past him before stepping forward to grab the wrist and twist it savagely. Wu yelped, and the knife fell to the floor. Ray pulled Wu out of the kitchen, pushed him into the middle of the sitting room, and back onto the sofa.
"I'll call the cops," shouted Wu.
"Yeah, of course you will," said Ray, picking up the knife.
"Same as you did when C.K. Lee chopped off your finger."
He walked over to the sofa and pointed the knife at the cast on Wu's leg.
"He did that to you too, did he?"
I don't know anyone called C.K. Lee," said Wu.
But there was no conviction in his voice as he stared at the knife in Ray's hand. Ray lifted his leg and stamped down on Wu's cast. Wu screamed in pain.
"I need to know where C.K. Lee is, Sammy, and you're going to tell me one way or another."
Wu gritted his teeth and stared fearfully up at Ray.
"So talk," said Ray, "or I'll start cutting off the rest of your fingers."
"You can't do that."
Ray grabbed Wu's left wrist and placed the edge of the blade against Wu's thumb.
"I can do what the fuck I want," he shouted. "And when I've finished on your fingers, I'll start on your toes. Now tell me, where the fuck is C.K. Lee?"
Wu shook his head fearfully.
"He'll kill me."
"He won't know it's you that told me. Now, where the fuck does C.K. Lee live?"
"I don't know,"
chatted Wu. Then he screamed as Ray drew the blade across the base of his thumb. Blood spurted across his palm.
"Okay, okay," shouted Wu. "For fuck's sake, stop."
"Just tell me where he lives, and I'm out of here," said Ray.
"I don't know,"
said Wu.
Ray reached out for Wu's wrist, and Wu folded his arms hurriedly.
"For fuck's sake, I don't know where he lives."
"Tell me something about him, Sammy. Something that will help me find him."
"He runs a gambling place on Lyle Street in Chinatown."
"Tell me something I don't know, Sammy."
He brandished the knife and reached out for Wu's wrist.
"For fuck's sake," chatted Wu, "why are you doing this?"
"I need to find him. I need to know where he lives."
"Why the fuck would I know where he lives? We're not friends. I owe him money and he cut off my finger and shattered my knee. If I don't pay him what I owe him, he'll take all my fingers one at a time."
Ray put his face near Wu's.
"Listen to me, Sammy, and listen to me good. When I get my hands on Lee,
He's not going to be collecting any debts. Trust me on that.
Wu licked his lips nervously. You're going to kill him?
That's for me to know, Sammy. But take my word, he won't be bothering you again. Now, give me something. Something I can use.
Wu nodded quickly. He's got a mistress. Had her for a year or so. Name of Lily. She should know where he is.
Ray grinned. And where do I find this Lily?
Wu screwed up his face. I don't know. I'm sorry.
Then that's no bloody help, is it? What about a phone number?
Wu shook his head. I just know that he has a mistress, that's all. She used to work in a brothel in Gloucester Place.
Where in Gloucester Place?
I don't know the number. It's a basement.
You've been there?
Wu nodded. It's run by Mrs. Wei. She's been around forever.
Tell me how to find it, said Ray.
And he listened as Wu ran through the directions. When he'd finished, Ray tossed the knife onto the sofa.
If I ever find out you've called Lee to warn him, I'll come back and cut off your dick, I swear to God.
Wu held up his bandaged hand. I don't owe him any favours, he said, and if you kill him, make sure it's painful. Chapter 31. A large steel gate rattled to the side, and a steward in a fluorescent jacket waved the coach through. The driver opened the door, and Joe McNamara and Tommy Brett got off first, followed by Martin Jessop. It was a short walk to the door that led to the changing rooms, which was being held open by another steward. Gabe stayed on the coach. He took out his mobile phone and called Ray, but it went through to voicemail.
"Gabe, that's a £500 fine,"
shouted McNamara, pointing at him through the window.
"You know the rules."
Gabe scowled and put the phone away. He jumped as a hand fell on his shoulder. It was Ronnie Watts.
"You okay, mate?" asked Watts from the seat behind him.
"Yeah," said Gabe.
"You worried about the penalty thing?"
Gabe grimaced but didn't reply.
"Mate, you'll be fine. You're in great form."
He squeezed Gabe's shoulder.
"I'd hate to be facing you, I can tell you that much."
He stood up. "Thanks, Ronnie," said Gabe. He'd completely forgotten about his penalty record, but he could hardly tell the keeper what was worrying him. He forced a smile. "Butterflies. I'll get over it." He followed Watts off the coach, his kit bag over his shoulder.
"Gabe!"
Gabe turned around to see a steward standing next to a young boy who wasn't much older than Ollie. It was Jerry McKee, one of the longest-serving stewards at the ground. He was in his 60s and had been a fan of the team for more than half a century.
"Jerry, how are you?"
"Just wanted to wish you luck, Gabe," said the steward, "and introduce you to my grandson, Alfie."
The boy was clearly nervous and biting his lower lip as he looked up at Gabe. Gabe smiled and offered the boy his hand. "Pleased to meet you, Alfie." The boy looked up at McGee and he nodded encouragement.
"Go on, lad."
The boy tentatively shook Gabe's hand. He was decked out in a team shirt with Gabe's number 10 on the back and a team scarf around his neck and was holding a program.
"Let me sign that for you," he said, and took out a pen.
He signed the front cover and handed the program back.
"I got Alfie and his dad seats in the main stand," said McGee.
"You should be with him," said Gabe.
McGee shook his head.
"Aye, the club needs me, Gabe."
Gabe grinned. "That's true. The place wouldn't be the same without you around." He smiled at Alfie. "Your granddad's been here every time I've played. Never missed a game."
"And I've seen you score some amazing goals," said McGee. "Remember that shot 2 years ago against Villa?"
"The cross from Eric, you mean?" "Perfect, wasn't it?"
"His cross was a bit high, to be honest," said McGee. "But you got it, brought it down, and that volley."
He shook his head in admiration.
"It was a blur, the ball. The keeper didn't even see it."
He patted his grandson on the shoulder.
"Anyway, we don't want to keep you. You have a great game, Gabe, and congratulations on being captain."
"Acting captain," said Gabe.
"How did you know?"
McGee tapped the side of his nose with his finger.
"We stewards know everything," he said.
Gabe laughed and hurried over to the door to the changing rooms, where McNamara was waiting impatiently.
"Fan club," said the coach.
"Jerry's been with the club longer than almost anyone," said Gabe, "and he'll probably be here long after we've gone." Through the door was the yellow-tiled corridor off which led the changing rooms. To the left were the facilities for the visitors,
a cramped room that hadn't been painted in years, with small lockers on the floor and hooks for larger items. There was a whiteboard that had been screwed unevenly by the fire doors, and two of the fluorescent bulbs in the ceiling didn't work. They had never worked. Just one of a dozen minor irritants that had been put in place to hopefully put visiting teams on the back foot. The showers were set to blast out cold water when switched on, with the thermostat only kicking in after 10 seconds or so. There was a treatment area with just two ancient massage beds and three sinks, one of which had a note on saying that it was blocked and wasn't to be used. To the right was the changing room used by Gabe and his teammates. It was 4 times the size of the away team's facilities. The physio area had an ice bath and 6 state-of-the-art massage beds, a medical station, a gym area with a range of exercise machines, and a huge locker area with floor-to-ceiling doors. On the front of each locker was a life-size picture of the player in action. Gabe went over to his locker and pulled it open. His kit was already hanging there, including a choice of long or short-sleeved shirt. The players were given brand new shirts for every game, and afterwards they were free to swap them or offer them to charities or fans. Gabe dropped his kit bag onto the bench in front of his locker. Inside the locker was a charging point for phones, even though the manager had forbidden their use in the changing rooms. There was an individual air conditioning unit, and Gabe turned his onto full cold and let the breeze play across his face. He flinched as McNamara blew his whistle to get everyone's attention. Gabe turned to see that Piero Gattuso was standing next to the coach, his hands thrust deep into the pockets of his cashmere overcoat. Gattuso was close to being obese, and his large feet were splayed out for balance, giving him the look of a king penguin looking for a fight. He had a mane of grey hair combed back and permanent flushed cheeks, and there was a small chunk of his left ear missing, rumoured to be the result of a brutal brawl when he was a teenager.
"I just drop in to wish you luck," he said, in his heavy Italian accent. "Not that you need luck."
He nodded at McNamara.
"Not with a coach like Joe. I just need you to go out there and do your best, because I know your best is more than enough to kick their arses."
There were several whoops and cheers from the team, but Gabe stayed silent. Gattuso was right. They were more than capable of beating Chelsea. But if they did, if United should win, he shuddered at the thought of what the consequences would be. If anything were to happen to Laura and Ollie, and it was his fault, he shuddered again.
"The owner's in his box with his family and 12 monks, so we need to put on a good show today," continued Gattuso. "He wants me to watch it in the box with him, so please, don't fucking let me down."
He turned on his heel and walked out.
"If he really has got 12 monks with him, then we're in deep shit," said Amati.
"Why's that?" asked McNamara.
"They only have even numbers of monks at funerals," said Amati. "When it's a wedding or a blessing, it's always an odd number." He shrugged. "I used to have a Thai girlfriend."
The team laughed. Amati changed his girlfriends about as often as he changed his wristwatch, which was pretty much on a daily basis.
"Well, I know we all appreciate the boss's pep talks, but I've got a few words to say myself," said McNamara. "The pundits have us down as easy winners, but we all know there are no easy victories, only easy defeats. I want you to go out there and play as if you're the underdogs, with heart. No slacking off, no thinking we've won the game before we set foot on the pitch. Got it?"
The players nodded.
"Excellent. Okay. Grab yourselves a snack and a drink, and then Tommy will go through the lineup with you and give you the weather briefing."
He looked at his watch.
"I know Marco and Michael want the physio to work on them. Anyone else need it?"
Amati raised his hand, and Devereaux laughed.
"You know you won't be getting a happy ending," he shouted.
Amati frowned.
"What is a happy ending?"
The players laughed and headed for the side room, where a range of healthy snacks, sandwiches, tea, coffee and soft drinks had been arranged on a large table. On the far wall was a large flat-screen TV, on which the coaching staff would replay highlights from the first half at half-time. McNamara walked over to Gabe.
"You okay?" he asked.
"Sure, fine. How are the knees?"
"Knees? Those funny-shaped things that connect your thighs to your shins," said the coach.
"Gabe,
Seriously, are you okay?
Yeah, sure, all good, Joe.
Are you hurting? Do you need to see the doc?
Joe, I'm fine, said Gabe. In fact, he hadn't given a thought to his knees from the moment he'd received the FaceTime call from Laura.
Pre-match jitters.
You never get worried before a game, said McNamara. He patted him on the back.
This is your big day, Gabe. One more penalty, and you're in the record books.
Gabe nodded. McNamara's eyes narrowed.
Seriously, Gabe, you're okay?
Of course, sure. He smiled as confidently as he could.
I'll give it 110%, Joe. You know I will.
McNamara grinned.
I know you will. You always do.
He handed him a black armband with the word Captain on it.
You'll be needing this.
Chapter 32. The address Sammy Wu had given Ray was a basement flat in a long line of white stucco houses. There was a gate set into the black railings at the front of the building, with a flight of metal steps leading down to a black door. A handwritten sign stuck to the wall stated the obvious, basement flat. Underneath were five Chinese characters, which Ray assumed meant the same in Chinese. He went down the stairs and pressed the doorbell. A few seconds later, the door was opened by a middle-aged Chinese woman in a dark blue denim dress.
"I'm a friend of Sammy Wu's," said Ray.
"Come in, come in," she said brusquely. "Not stand on doorstep."
She ushered him inside and closed the door. They were in a hallway with a laminated wood floor and a narrow black table on which an incense stick was smouldering, filling the air with the scent of jasmine. Two open doors led off to the left, and at the end of the corridor was another door, closed.
"In there,"
she said, pointing at the door closest to him.
"Are you Mrs. Wei?" he asked.
"Talk in room," she said impatiently. "In, in."
Ray did as he was told. It was a small bedroom with a double bed covered in a red sheet with matching pillows. Thick curtains were drawn across the window, and the only light came from a bedside lamp, over which had been draped a red silk scarf. On a bedside table was a glass bowl containing a variety of condoms, a box of tissues, and a tube of KY jelly that, from the look of it, had been well used. Ray suppressed a shudder as he turned around to look at Mrs. Wei. Close up, even under the red light, it was clear that Mrs. Wei was well over 60. Her face was smooth and unlined, but unnaturally so, as if her skin was made of wax. But it was her hands that gave her age away. They were rough and wrinkled and dotted with liver spots, and the nails were yellowing. The skin around her neck was mottled and loose, and Ray realized she was closer to 70.
"I have four girls today," she said, "all young and all pretty. I will show you them, and you can choose."
Ray put up a hand to silence her.
"Sammy told me that Lily used to work here."
"She left," said Mrs. Wei. "Rose is same Lily. Young and sweet. I will get Rose for you."
"Mrs. Wei, I just want to talk to Lily."
Mrs. Wei sighed. "She not here, I tell you already."
Ray reached into his trouser pocket and pulled out a money clip with a thick wad of £50 notes.
"Sammy Wu said you might know where I can find Lily."
Mrs. Wei screwed up her face as she peered at the notes.
"What you want, Lily?" she barked.
"I just need to talk to her. It's nothing bad, I promise. I'll pay her, too."
"How much?"
she said, her eyes still on the wad of £50 notes.
£500, if you can give me her address.
She looked up from the notes and tilted her head on one side.
"How I know you're not police?"
"Because I'm offering to pay you for information."
"The police pay. Entrapment."
"Do I look like a cop?"
He held up the money.
"Do cops carry money around like this?"
She shrugged.
"Who knows what cop look like? Take off clothes."
"What?"
"Take off clothes," she repeated. "I don't want a massage, I want information. You want information, you'll take off clothes."
"Are you serious?"
Mrs. Wei didn't say anything. She just folded her arms and stared at him impassively. Ray sighed and took off his jacket. He tossed it onto the bed, then kicked off his shoes and took off his trousers. He stood in his boxer shorts, his arms out to the side.
"Happy now?" he said.
"Take off everything," said Mrs. Wei. "For fuck's sake," said Ray. "No need for bad language," she said. "Policemen cannot take off clothes. That is rule."
"I'm not sure that's true," said Ray.
When he saw that Mrs. Wei was serious, he sighed and took off his shorts.
"Okay."
Mrs. Wei turned her head and shouted in Chinese. A few seconds later he heard soft footsteps in the hallway, and a Chinese girl appeared in the doorway. She was in her late 20s with a pageboy haircut and bright red lipstick. She was wearing a white knee-length nightdress cut low to show a cleavage that was so impressive that her breasts must have been enhanced. Ray shook his head.
"I don't want a massage."
Mrs. Wei ignored him. She spoke to the girl in Chinese, and the girl got down on her knees in front of Ray.
"No fucking way," said Ray, taking a step back. "I told you, no bad language," said Mrs. Wei sternly. "She give you oral? I know you not police. She not give you oral?"
Mrs. Wei shrugged.
"This way, I know for sure. Policeman cannot have oral. That is a rule." "Mrs. Wei, this is crazy."
She looked at him and shrugged again. Ray sighed.
"Okay, fine."
He looked down at the girl, and she smiled up at him.
"Go ahead."
Mrs. Wei spoke to the girl in Chinese, and her smile widened. Her teeth were perfectly even and gleamingly white. She moved towards him, and from the way her breasts moved, Ray figured they were probably real after all. Ray closed his eyes as she took him in her soft, warm mouth. Her hands stroked the inside of his thighs, and Ray felt himself grow hard. Then Mrs. Wei clapped her hands.
"Okay, enough," she said.
The girl moved back, licking her lips. Ray opened his eyes. Mrs. Wei spoke to the girl in Chinese, and the girl stood up.
"Give her £50, said Mrs. Wei.
Ray bent down and retrieved his money clip from his trousers. He gave the girl a £50 note, and she took it and left the room. Mrs. Wei held out her hand.
"My money," she said.
Ray gave her £500.
"Okay if I get dressed now." "If you want to stay naked, up to you."
Ray dressed quickly as Mrs. Wei checked the banknotes.
"So, what you want to know?" she asked. "I just want to know where I can find Lily," pulling on his trousers. "She stay in Knightsbridge, near Howard's." "C.K. Lee takes care of her now."
Mrs. Wei's face hardened.
"You know Mr. Lee?"
"I know of him."
"Bad man," she said. "You be careful." "Yeah, I'm not hearing good things about him," said Ray.
He buttoned up his shirt and slipped on his shoes.
"He took Lily."
Mrs. Wei nodded.
"I paid a lot to get her into the country, many thousands of pounds. But Mr. Lee said he wanted her. He liked young girls. Lily was the third girl he took from me." "So, why'd you let him come here?"
Her eyebrows arched.
"You think I can stop him? You think I can stop him doing what he wants?"
She shook her head.
"Mr. Lee always get what he wants."
She held up her dainty left hand, and for the first time he realized that the tip of her little finger was missing.
"This is what happened while I tried to stop him," she said. "I had a girl here before Lily. Mr. Lee wanted her, and I said no."
She waved the hand in front of Ray's face.
"He did this to me, and I never said no again." "Bloody hell," said Ray, putting on his jacket. "Why didn't you go to the police?" "Police cannot help," she said. "And if I tell the police, I lose more than a finger." She shrugged. "Mr. Lee does not care about the police, not here and not in China."
Ray nodded.
"I'm sorry," he said, and he genuinely meant it. "But thank you for your help."
Mrs. Wei held up the £50 notes.
"No need for thank you," she said. "Money is thank you enough."
Chapter 33. The team sat for half an hour listening to Martin Jessop go through the opposition lineup and fine-tuning their set pieces to take account of the fact that Chelsea's main defender had been dropped because of a tendon injury and replaced with a left-footer. Gabe sat with a coffee trying to listen, but all he could think of was his wife and son being held at gunpoint. Could he really do that? He was just one man in a team of 11. Could one man actually throw a game? What if he tried and failed? Would the kidnappers carry out their threat? And if they did, how could he live with himself? And what if he did throw the match? How could he be sure the kidnappers would release his family? He realized he was gritting his teeth, and he took a deep breath. Now wasn't the time to be tensing up. He slipped his phone out of his pocket and stole a quick look at the screen. Ray hadn't called. He put the phone away and sipped his coffee. His heart was pounding so hard it felt as if it was about to burst out of his chest. He took another sip of coffee and realized that the players in front of him had twisted around to look at him and that Jessop was looking at him expectantly. Sorry,
said Gabe. I missed that.
Focus, Gabe, said Jessop. I know that you find the pre-match briefings as dull as ditchwater, but you might at least pretend to be listening. Sorry, Martin. My bad. He raised his coffee mug. Won't happen again. All I said was that any penalties will, of course, be down to you, unless you say otherwise. For any of you who have been living under a rock the past week, Gabe is just one penalty away from breaking the record for the most consecutive penalties scored. I'm not suggesting that any of you start diving in the opposition's penalty box, but every little helps. Gabe raised his coffee mug in salute. That's all for now, guys, said Jessop. He looked over at a wall-mounted clock. It's now 1:45. We'll be out for a warm-up at 2. Until then, do whatever you have to do. Gabe stood up and hurried over to the toilet. He waited until he was in a cubicle with the door closed before pulling out his phone. He called Ray's number, but it went straight through to voicemail.
Ray, what the hell's happening? He hissed. Just over an hour to go. Where are you? Did you find that guy Lee?
He ended the call, then slammed his hand against the side of the cubicle, hard. He called again and left a second message.
Let me know what's happening, Ray. They make it difficult for us to use our phones on match day, so send me a text or leave me a message.
He felt tears stinging his eyes, and he blinked them away.
I'm scared, Ray. I'm so scared. I don't know what to do.
He took a deep breath and let it out slowly, annoyed at himself for getting so emotional.
If I don't hear from you, I'll do what I can to throw the game. Like I said, just over an hour to go.
He closed his eyes, trying to think what else he should say, but nothing came to mind.
Thanks, Ray, he said eventually. Thanks for this.
He ended the call and wiped his eyes with the back of his hand.